Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Cauliflower used to be the wallflower at the vegetable dance. Not anymore. Food writer Nicole Spyridakis will explain. Then we'll hear from NPR's Daniel Zwerdling about what they're eating in Antarctica. And from there, we'll move south with super chef Alton Brown. So, let's dig in. Nicole Spyridakis lives in San Francisco and writes about food and travel on her blog, Cucina Nicolina. She has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about her passion for cauliflower. She joins me today. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Bonnie.
In the piece you did for Kitchen Window Online, you call your feeling about cauliflower an obsession. Why?
I guess that's a bit of a strong word to use. However, I've realized that in the past probably 6 months, I've made roasted cauliflower or some sort of cauliflower dish at least once a week. And I feel like that is bordering on obsession because it just tastes so good.
And you're fairly new to cauliflower.
I am, because I think when I was growing up, you know, whenever I used to eat it, it was mostly steamed, and I just didn't like it. I found it very bland. And then I came across a recipe for roasting a cauliflower, and I got into roasting a lot of other vegetables as well. But I made the cauliflower, and it was like an epiphany. It was so good.
Well, cauliflower is one of those sort of institutionally destroyed vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of things do you do with cauliflower other than roast it?
Well, I make a soup, which I put the recipe in the column. And that I like because it's pretty simple, but you can really taste this kind of sweet taste of the cauliflower. And then I make a gratin that it was actually inspired by, my boyfriend is part Norwegian, and it's inspired by his grandmother. She made it a lot in Norway because there's a lot of cauliflower in Norway. I guess it's a good cold weather crop.
Huh.
That's kind of nice to do. So,
and you write in your piece that you were inspired at the farmer's market. And I've noticed in the last couple of years that there is a lot more cauliflower, and it's very exotic looking.
It is. It's not just the white, plain stuff that we see at the supermarket. There's purple cauliflower, and then these kind of spiky green ones, which I like. Those are kind of neat. And those taste similarly. And with some of those, I just like to do a simple stir fry kind of with garlic and onions and chickpeas.
Mm.
Very good.
There are yellow ones too. Very, very dark yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Are they new varieties? Are they hybrids? Are they heirloom varieties that people are bringing back?
Probably most of these have been around. I think that at least in America, people are becoming more willing to try a variety of vegetables. I think the focus is turning back toward organic and local and seasonal. So people are more open to trying things that are kind of funny looking. And I think that maybe that's one of the reasons that we're seeing them more is because just sort of in general, people are more willing to embrace them.
And they are somewhat off-putting. The green one sort of looks like a brontosaurus or something.
Mm-hmm. I think it looks actually quite beautiful, but
yeah.
but because it is so different. But yeah, I mean, it is like you have to change your whole sort of approach, I think, because I did this with cauliflower. I mean, I always thought it was kind of boring and I wasn't interested, but you know, I did know that it was good for me, and I do like to try a lot of different vegetables, and so I thought, well, let me just give it another try. So if we can just give these things a try, you know, it will be pleasantly surprised, I think.
Why do you think cauliflower has such a bad rap?
I think because of a lot of the ways it has been prepared. I was in D.C. a couple months ago, and I went out to dinner, and I had this pasta dish, and it was like all these vegetables, and cauliflower was in it, and it was just, they weren't cooked very well. They were kind of hard, and there wasn't any seasoning, you know, and I was thinking, like, if I didn't like cauliflower because of the other times I have made it, I probably wouldn't have eaten it. You know, it wasn't enticing at all.
Well, if it's overcooked, oversteamed or something, it gets kind of watery.
Right.
Tell me about roasting cauliflower.
Roasting cauliflower is one of the simplest things that you can do, and you can really use this, I think, to almost any vegetable, because I do with asparagus as well, but for some reason, when you do roasted cauliflower and you put a little bit of olive oil and salt and you just put it in the oven, it just turns it into this wonderful side dish. The cauliflower becomes a bit caramelized, so the sweetness comes out, and it's just, it really is addictive, and that's probably why I say that I'm obsessed. It's because of this dish. And everyone that I've made it for is just really amazed by how good it is.
How high a heat do you use?
400 degrees, and it takes about 20 minutes.
Hmm. And you break it in florets? And...
Right, yeah, you take the head, you break it up, you kind of swirl around some olive oil and salt, put it in a pan, put it in the oven on 400, and then, you know, make the rest of your meal, and then it's done.
Do you mix cauliflower with other vegetables, or do they overpower the delicacy of it?
I do. So, well, in the gratin recipe, actually, that I include with this piece, I put some onions, garlic, and tomatoes. So those are kind of like delicate flavor themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I could do a stir fry, you know, with some other squash maybe and cauliflower. But I do like to have just the flavor of it. So most of the time I do it by itself.
Well, I can't wait to go home and roast some cauliflower. It not only sounds delicious, but it's so easy. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thanks, Bonnie.
That was Nicole Spyridakis, a food and travel writer who lives in San Francisco. Nicole's cauliflower dishes might be very welcome in Antarctica, where any good food is, well, an icebreaker. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling tells NPR's Lynn Neary what they're eating on that cold continent.
The cooking of Antarctica. Just think about how much you and I mean, how much some people think about what they eat day to day. So imagine now that you're living in the most extreme place on the planet. Meals take on a special power.
You know, I have to admit, I have never thought about the cuisine of Antarctica, so I am interested.
And I hadn't until I went there. So to explain, let's start our food tour just off Antarctica's coast. One afternoon, I joined a scientist named Donald Manahan, and we're actually walking on top of the sea. It's frozen under 6 feet of ice. Manahan's research team is digging a hole through this ice because they're studying how global warming is affecting life underwater. And Lynn, as we're standing there, what do you think this scientist is thinking about? Carbon dioxide emissions?
The future of civilization?
Nope. He's thinking about dinner.
I've never enjoyed food more in my life than I have working in Antarctica.
Lynn, picture the context. There is nothing green on the continent. No trees, no bushes, not a single blade of grass. At the moment, it's 10 degrees below zero with the wind chill. And Manahan says this strange environment can make you feel off balance. So meals are a serious matter.
One of the things that really makes you feel alive is to come out here, do this work in the cold, and then zoom back to the base and have a nice, warm dinner. Yum, yum. One of the things they pay a huge amount of attention to here is the quality of the food. Trying to make sure there's a lot of variety because, you know, it does affect your psychology.
That's why the emotional center of America's main base in Antarctica is the cafeteria.
Hi, whole wheat with Dijon mustard, prime rib, provolone.
The dining hall is in the main building in the middle of the complex. They call it McMurdo Station. And it's, well, it's ugly. The U.S. Navy built most of this base in the 1950s and 60s. And they chose a spectacular setting that looks out at the frozen sea and at an icy mountain range. But then they ruined the view. It's a jumble of corrugated metal buildings and tacky dormitories. They painted everything sickly brown.
Can I get a turkey sandwich on wheat?
About 1,100 people live here during Antarctica's long summer. But only a few hundred are actually scientists. Most of the staff drive bulldozers or fix leaky roofs, or they cook. Like Amanda Bell.
I'm trying to remix the chocolate. We made a chocolate glaze of butter, cream, and dark chocolate to put on top of the eclairs. Would you like to try one?
These are the people who keep the place running, so scientists can work in Antarctica at all. The head chef at McMurdo is Sally Ayotte. She's wiry, like a sprinter. In fact, she races to the kitchen past giant deep-fat fryers. Ayotte says the first time she came to Antarctica, it was back in the 1990s. And when she stepped off the plane...
I looked around and was like, oh my God, what have I done? It's easy to see that you're just at the bottom of the world. You're in the middle of nowhere.
Ayotte says she got sort of depressed. Everything's upside down in Antarctica. The sun rises once each year. Then it blazes 24 hours a day for months. Then the sun sets only once a year. And it stays dark for months. And most people are basically trapped here. You can't wander far from the base or you could die. But Ayat says one day it suddenly hit her. Everybody else in Antarctica was in the same boat.
You work, you sleep, you eat.
And she realized she could make a huge difference in people's lives just by making them happy when they eat. To show how she and her cooks try to do it, Ayat takes us on a tour.
So please, of course, step this way, watch your step.
To begin with, it's all you can eat in Antarctica. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. There's often an omelette station and maybe a roast beef station. And there are rows of stainless steel warming trays piled with mountains of food.
We have the chili for lunch today. We have the pub cod with fries.
And there could be spicy shrimp with rice noodles. Grilled mahi-mahi with papaya salsa. If you're a vegetarian, there's mushroom and barley risotto or falafel with tzatziki sauce. Now, this menu might not sound unusual if you were visiting, say, a university in California, but this is the bottom of the world. They get most of their food by ship. The ship makes one delivery per year after the icebreaker clears the way. So most of their ingredients are frozen, canned, or dried. And Ayat says that's a challenge for cooks who train in the States.
A lot of folks that come from restaurants to here are used to dealing with high-quality produce every single day. So learning, experimenting, figuring out ways to work with dehydrated peppers and dry vegetable broth powder and things like that. How do you make a great meal out of ingredients that might not be the norm?
And there are repercussions when they don't pull it off. Ask anybody in the dining room.
You can make or break the morale of the whole station just by the food they serve.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Absolutely.
Mike Ebel is one of the lead maintenance guys. He's sitting at the table with Dave Ackley from Plumbing.
Ask anybody about the food. It's on good food days, the town is happy. On bad food days, we kind of grump around.
Sometimes we all walk away saying, yuck. The cod we got today is pretty good stuff.
Donald Manahan, the scientist, says maybe this isn't the perfect analogy, but mealtime in Antarctica can push people's buttons just like it does in a prison or a nursing home.
There's a feeling of loss of control, and they have to eat whatever shows up that day. And day in, day out, you don't have any control of that. You know, my grandmother, I remember having this conversation with her, and the rest of the family went, oh, she's fine, the food is great, this and the other. And I said, you know, I've just come back from 3 months in Antarctica. And it started to bother me. It starts to get at you. It sounds trivial if you've never been through it, but it's like you're institutionalized.
And occasionally, people lose it. It happened once to Mike Ebel.
I cleared that galley once. I cleared the whole serving area. It was 1994. They curried everything. There was so much curry, curry dessert, curry this, curry that. I just went berserk. They were peeking around the corners at me. Mike, calm down. And all the food and plates got in the way.
By the way, Lynn, despite that embarrassing incident, Mike Ebel has become a valued employee in Antarctica. In fact, government officials just named a small mountain range for him in Antarctica. Ebel Hills, 7,500 feet high.
Oh, that's great. You know, Danny, I know that you and your wife used to write restaurant reviews.
That's right.
So what's your professional critique of the food in Antarctica?
You know, you have to consider that the cooks in Antarctica face crazy challenges. And in view of that, they do very well. On the other hand, Lynn, powdered potatoes can only go so far. So put it this way. When I'd walk into the cafeteria after spending the day on the freezing ice, at that moment, I'd rate the cuisine in Antarctica 4 stars out of 5.
NPR's Danny Zwerdling, thanks so much for being with us. And if you go to npr.org, you'll find a recipe for Danny's favorite dessert in Antarctica, moist Moroccan cake with mint.
To warm up a little, we'll go with celebrity chef Alton Brown on a food road trip along the Mississippi River. He ate his way north from the Gulf of Mexico to the river's headwaters in Minnesota. His adventures led to a book called Feasting on Asphalt. He talks with NPR's Leanne Hansen.
Okay, you and your nine buds have motorcycles and said, hey, I know what, let's go up the Mississippi River.
Well, the Mississippi is really America's original highway. We would not be what we are without the Mississippi. So we had done one feasting on asphalt already where we had crossed the country from east to west. So the natural thing to do was to go north to south or south to north up this amazing highway that really is kind of the aorta of America.
You started in New Orleans. I mean, please, you know, again.
Well, we started all the way at the very, very, very end of the river at Head of Passes, which is, you know, practically halfway out in the Gulf, quite a bit south of New Orleans to really get the full trip.
What'd you have to eat?
You know, there's not a lot to eat down there because there's still not a lot there. We ate at one place that was a little barbecue joint on the side of the road that had kind of rebuilt, you know, and the people that were working there were living in FEMA trailers and, you know, getting up early in the morning and starting the barbecue and baking biscuits. And it was a really good send-off for the trip because we were really kind of looking for tradition and nostalgia in a place where it had all been wiped away.
On your trip through Louisiana toward Mississippi, you stopped at, is it Kleibert's Turtle and Alligator Tours?
Yeah, and it's basically, oh man, Kleibert takes us inside this fence where this giant pond is and leaves us there. he leaves us. And to go off to get frozen Nutra, which is the little rodent that they feed to the alligators. And, you know, I'm standing on this concrete kind of ramp, you know, as these dinosaurs essentially start kind of lumbering up because they assume that I've brought something to eat. You know, those things can move very quickly when they get a mind to.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to face it because, I mean, we eat them, right? And,
yeah.
And how often do you get to face something that we eat that could eat you?
That's true.
So, you know, face-to-face with a big reptile that you intend to eat, I felt that was necessary.
Tell us about the face a guy made when you were on the road that you told him you were going north and he basically said, you know, why are you going outside Louisiana?
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
He snorted. It was kind of, there's nothing up there. You know, he really did believe that beyond the northern border of Louisiana, all worthwhile food ceased to exist. Of course, that wasn't the case.
Right.
But the people in Louisiana certainly seemed sure of it.
You moved across the border into Mississippi and you had catfish given with spaghetti?
Yeah. And I, you know, ignorant white boy, I guess. I had not heard of spaghetti catfish dinners and didn't put together why that combination would be potent. And, of course, it's potent because it's cheap. Catfish is plentiful, and spaghetti in large amounts is very simple to make and very inexpensive.
What are coolickles? Is that how you pronounce it?
Coolickle, yeah.
Coolickles,
you
Mississippi.
Nailed it, coolickle. The first time I locked eyes on a coolickle, I thought I was looking at something like a preserved armadillo spleen because I had never seen a dill pickle pink. So my brain immediately did not say, that's a pickle. I thought, that's an organ, you know, something. But it's basically a kosher dill that has been re-cured in a souped-up Kool-Aid solution. This sounds hideous. It is refreshing, sweet and tart, you know, sour, salty. It's fantastic.
Barbecue. I mean, you really traveled south to north, mm-hmm. eating barbecue along the way. Is there one standout?
Yeah, it would be Prince Barbecue. And I'm trying to remember the...
Bardwell, Kentucky.
Yeah. The really groovy thing about this place was they only make so much because it's this one guy who's making this, and people were driving in, and we had taken the last of the barbecue, and I'd see them go up to the little booth, and they'd have a few words with them, and then they'd look over at us like, I hate you, you foreigners, you know, coming in here. And I actually kind of found myself kind of turning away, you know, like they're either going to come take my barbecue away or they hate me for having it. But the thing that I most regret about the whole trip is that they were just putting on mutton. You have no idea how difficult it is to find mutton in this country, which, of course, is sheep that's over a year old. It's not lamb anymore. And once a week, this guy smokes for like 18 hours, several whole sides of mutton. And he only does this on Thursdays and Fridays, and he only sells it on Saturday mornings. And I wanted nothing more. We couldn't stay. We had to move on. But that would have been a real pilgrimage.
As you traveled north, how did the food change? I mean, anecdotally, one would think it would go from hot and spicy to white.
That wouldn't be an unfair analogy. What happens is that it becomes subtle. in the South where food is fixated upon, and it's not just a point of pride, it is the primary cultural touch point. As you move north, certainly as you move into places like Missouri and Iowa, things change. But they don't just get white and mild. You just have to start looking at real subtleties. There's still a lot of flavor there. It's just not going to hit you in the head with a baseball bat the way that it does down south.
Your last place, it's too cold to camp out, so you stay at the Nordic Inn.
That's the strangest thing I have ever beheld. It was like falling into a David Lynch movie.
It's in Crosby, Minnesota.
Yeah, and I can't sum up that experience. I think that for us, part of it was fatigue. We were really rode out, you know, at this point of the game. And then all of a sudden, we're in this place where they're dressing us up as Vikings and dressing some of us up as girl Vikings, which is even more uncomfortable.
Dressing you up?
Yeah.
You allowed them to put clothes on your body?
I was just trying to get by, you know, just trying to make it through the day.
Is there footage of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the show, and there's some shots in the book.
But it looks like a hearty meal you had.
Yeah, it was hearty, and most certainly the strangest culinary event of my life.
You took on this trip, you wanted to take a taste of American road food. I don't know, from what you've got in your book and the show, it seems like it's in pretty good shape.
It is still there. To say that it's in pretty good shape, there are a lot of places that are barely hanging on. For instance, two of the places that we visited on the trip, Joe's White Front, which I think is in Rosedale, Mississippi, and then Bright Box in Iowa, which is the oldest restaurant in Iowa, both burned down since the show. And in the case of Joe's White Front, I doubt they even had insurance because this was subsistence, or what I call subsistence restauranting, where you're kind of just barely getting by. You're grandfathered in on 15 different things. And I imagine that place now is gone forever. So they are there, but I wouldn't say that all is well in road food. No, I wouldn't. I mean, we've got an opportunity to save it. You know, the dodo bird's not dead yet, but it's getting there.
Well, going out on the road might be a decent idea. I mean, I don't know, with the price of gas, that's going to be tough for folks to take road trips.
Well, you know, the thing, though, is if you get your head in the right place, you can drive, you know, an easy day's journey someplace and get more out of it and get more out of that tank of gas than you would, you know, flying to Disneyland. The trip in America can be the destination. So I would really like to see people get back on the road and enjoy travel for travel's sake.
Thanks a lot, Alton.
You're very welcome.
Alton Brown is a prominent personality on the Food Network. We've been talking about his book, which is based on his adventures filming the series Feasting on Asphalt. Today, he begins filming a new series, Feasting on Waves. You can find recipes for coulicles, fried pork sandwiches, and pecan coconut pie at npr.org/books.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for lots of recipes, like those for cauliflower, and more food stories. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.